Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, today's date is October 22, 2019. This panel of the court is in courtroom 200. We have six cases on the calendar today, four of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A-182125, State versus Donald Michael Weigel, or Weigel. Mr. Donovan, you may approach whenever you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Donald Weigel. Mr. Weigel was convicted of first-degree controlled substance crime after law enforcement executed a search warrant and discovered a large amount of methamphetamine at his home. Now, that search warrant was issued based on an earlier search warrant, which authorized law enforcement to place a GPS tracking device on Mr. Weigel's truck. And it's that first search warrant which is at issue today. The question is whether the issuing magistrate had a substantial basis to determine that probable cause supported placing a GPS on that truck. Now, that first warrant suffered from two fatal flaws. First, there was no nexus to connect drug trafficking with Mr. Weigel's truck's movement and location.
Is that really true, though? Didn't the informant talk about a truck?
The informant mentioned a truck.
And didn't the officer verify that he was driving a truck? In fact, that the truck was parked near someone's house on January 6th, and that person's house apparently was a known meth dealer. And in addition, didn't the informant say that he had actually seen drugs in that truck?
That's all true. Those are really the only facts in this entire search warrant that connect the truck to drug dealing.
Why is that insufficient?
Because what those facts really go to is, rather than a search of the truck's movement and location, which is sort of what we're talking about, I think the parties agree that nexus has to be not just the truck's movement and location and drug trafficking. Yeah. So just starting with that first fact.
The truck moved here and moved right to a house that was a known meth dealer house.
But we don't know that truck moved with any drugs in it. We don't know his reason for being there. We know from the informant that he actually stayed with a female in Maple Grove. I think that might be the same house. We don't know if he is there. We don't know how long he's there. Basically, the facts that are there go more towards searching the truck rather than the movement location. I don't think they get there either. But what we need here is the informant not just saying, well, I saw some drugs in the truck. We need more on, first of all, when did he see these drugs in the truck? I think the best that we can say is maybe 12 days ago, that at the soonest. Drugs are something easily disposable, incriminating. We need more fresh information. But more importantly,
any case that say you need more than 12 days is insufficient?
Well, I think with something like drugs, there's not a bright line rule.
In terms of staleness, that's what you're talking about.
Yes. Drugs are items that...
Yeah, good question. Any case that has said that 12 days interval is a staleness issue?
No, again, there's not a bright line rule, but I think that they've said six is getting pretty close. But more importantly, what this informant is not saying is that he's seen Mr. Weigel use the truck to move drugs. He saw the drugs in the truck. He doesn't say, look, we frequently go to a third location, and so he must have these drugs in this truck. He goes to this house in Maple Grove because that's his supplier. He's supplying that person.
Also say that his contact with your client was that he wanted to get drugs from him.
Sure.
And in that process is when he sees the drugs in the truck.
That's not correct, Your Honor.
That's correct?
No, he's arrested en route to buy drugs to Mr. Weigel. He does not see any drugs there at that time. We don't know where he was going. We don't know if he's meeting Mr. Weigel at his truck, if he's meeting Mr. Weigel at his home, where he's going. He's just saying he was going there when he was arrested. So it's not the same time as when he saw the drugs in the truck. Those are two different instances. Okay. Again, he's never saying that he is going and meeting Mr. Weigel in places. And there, he's seeing him transport these drugs. We know that there are drugs in the truck once, again, maybe 12 days ago, we don't know for sure, but there are no other facts alleged in this warrant that suggest that Mr. Weigel is using the truck to distribute these drugs, that he is some sort of mobile dealer who is going from place to place and always taking these drugs. I think if we step back and sort of look at the state's argument, what the state is sort of arguing here is that whenever we know that we have a drug dealer who has a car, we can place a GPS on that car and learn more information. But we're sort of going in reverse order with that. We need a little bit more information. We need some facts that that vehicle is involved with trafficking before that GPS should be, or probable cause for that GPS should exist.
Well, but don't you draw some reasonable inferences about the drugs being in the truck? Two possibilities. Either just storing them in the truck or he's moving them.
Sure, but when, I think it's the Ward case that says when you don't have one reason to prefer an inference over another, we're not necessarily going to give deference to the issuing magistrate's choice between those inferences. And again, the time is key. We don't know when it was.
Well, didn't the informant also, though, say that it wasn't just drugs, it was a large amount of drugs? Wouldn't that be suggestive of, or wouldn't that lead to a reasonable inference on behalf of the issuing magistrate that this wasn't just personal use amounts, this guy was a dealer?
Mm-hmm.
And had a large amount of drugs in his truck that the informant told him about. Doesn't that connect the truck containing a large amount of, isn't that another factor that connects the truck to the alleged drug dealing by your client?
Well, I think a couple of things with that. First of all, we don't have, again, any facts about how much a large amount of drugs is. I think that a large amount of methamphetamine to you and I might be different from a large amount of methamphetamine to someone who's using methamphetamine. So we don't know how much there is. And again, it comes down to sort of a question of, is he a dealer, is he a trafficker? They clearly think he's a trafficker. But they don't have any facts to really support that alleged in this warrant that he is a trafficker.
Well, there's a large amount of drugs in the truck, and within 12 days, he was seen carrying a handgun by the informant also.
Sure, but that doesn't necessarily suggest that Mr. Weigel is a trafficker because he'd previously had a handgun and been arrested. He's got a couple of handgun offenses. He doesn't have any previous controlled substance sale convictions in his record to say, well, I guess we can sort of use his record in some of the other cases where they say, oh, you know, we've got a lot of them, or if you have possession with intent to sell, we're going to sort of think you're a trafficker. He has a third-degree possession, which, you know, the scheme of things here, is rather low level. It doesn't suggest that he's been a dealer in the past or that he's a trafficker now.
Did the record say anything about, I can't remember this, I know in terms of what his prior conviction was, but is that what he was charged with, or had he been charged with a sale case that was pled down to a...
The facts that the magistrate had were that he was convicted of possession, third-degree possession of a controlled substance, ineligible person in possession of a firearm, reckless discharge of a firearm, burglary, and I believe possession of burglary tools. So we don't know what he was ever charged with. But the facts in front of the magistrate were that it was a third-degree possession, and that's it. So we don't have this long rap sheet of drug-related offenses to sort of help guide that inference that he is a trafficker. I mean, at best, again, it's just to search the truck. It's close to searching the truck. We don't know when he saw the drugs. We don't know how long that period of time was between seeing the drugs and then telling Deputy French this information. And this is a very invasive search that they're doing. United States versus Jones, you know, ultimately the holding of that case came down to the idea that trespass is a search, but five of the other justices between the two concurrences talk about how invasive of a search this is. This is 60 days of knowing his entire movement and location, which is far beyond what you typically have when you're just trailing someone. So they're going to put this sort of a search out there with such minimal information. There just needs to be more to get probable cause to conduct this kind of search.
The search warrant application also mentions that he has rented a storage locker.
Sure.
Isn't it natural to believe that he probably would be using his truck? Well, the storage locker might be used for drugs, and he would be using his truck to go back and forth to the storage locker, which they don't know where it is.
Correct. I think that this is, again, them sort of putting the cart before the horse, because there's no facts alleged before that say, you know, he uses a storage locker. We don't even have the deputy saying, in my training and experience, I know that drug traffickers use storage units. Having a storage unit in and of itself is not some sort of suspicious activity. They put that afterwards. They're trying to find out what they don't know. They just don't know enough to get to the point of learning what they don't know. Just saying he has a storage locker doesn't mean that it's involved with drugs. It means they just want to know what's in that storage locker. Again, if this informant had said, I know that he has a storage locker, I know that he visits there, he's keeping money or keeping drugs or keeping guns or some sort of incriminating activity, if there were more facts alleged related to that storage locker, but again, there's just nothing really in this nexus that can connect to the truck's movement and location to drug dealing. Just to sort of briefly touch on this informant, since we've been speaking so much on him, this is also an informant who's really not reliable. I think ultimately, not reliable. He's an unreliable informant. We're dealing with essentially two factors here of the whole confidential informant to show reliability. One is that he makes a statement against interest. That is of minimal value in this equation. And I think more importantly, as I'm sort of preparing for this case, I'm questioning if he's even making a statement against interest. If he tells Deputy French, I was on my way to go buy drugs, I don't know that he's really made a statement against his interest because attempted fifth-degree possession is not a crime. He's not really saying anything that's going to get him in trouble. He said, I was going to do something, but now he's not. Really, we don't know why he's arrested. We don't have any information about that, so we don't know how long it has been since he's been arrested, going more to that staleness issue. And the other facts are the level of detail that he's providing about Mr. Weigel is very scant. He basically says, I was going to buy drugs, I've seen drugs in the past, and the rest is just a lot of biographical details that are very easily obtained information. I think, you know, the state suggests he didn't look, you know, or he maybe looked these up and memorized them. These are just everyday details you know about people. If I come into contact with you on a regular basis, there's a pretty good chance I know where you live, I know what kind of car you drive roughly, and I know what your job is. These aren't some sort of, you know, hard to know, only he would know them.
He also knew where somebody else, where he was staying, and then there wasn't his address.
Sure, he lived with his mother. He stayed with a woman in Maple Grove. And the informant didn't say he's staying there because that's a drug dealer. He didn't say, again, that's a supplier or that's a dealer he's providing. He doesn't say any of that. He says he stays with her, with the woman in Maple Grove.
That's a lot of information.
Does he have a lot of information, though? Again, knowing someone's job, knowing their car, knowing their address, and knowing that they stay at their girlfriend's house, this isn't necessarily a ton of information. I know probably 1,000 people, their car, their job, and where they live roughly. This isn't, you know, some sort of facts that are hard for him to know. And again, it's also not predictive of any sort of criminal behavior. He doesn't say, go to this Maple Grove house.
He also knows the criminal history of this person.
He doesn't know, he knows he has convictions. He doesn't know what they are. It's not listed that he told me that he was convicted of that. He just says, I know he has convictions. Again, this is not hard information to obtain, and it's maybe something you know about someone, especially if, you know, you're doing drugs or maybe a criminal as well. You might know who else has a criminal background. And none of this information is predictive. He doesn't send Deputy French to that Maple Grove house because he says he goes there on Thursdays. That's when he goes and picks up a supply or he drops it off. He just says he stays there. Deputy French happens to go there at a time when that truck is there. And we don't know how long he was there. We don't know where he went before. We don't know where he went after. We just don't know any information about this truck's movement and location, suggesting that that is also some sort of criminal activity connecting all of this.
Yeah, but you know that the house was related to a drug dealing activity where his truck was observed, right?
We know that it is the house of a drug dealer. I don't know that we know that the house is even involved in drug dealing, just that a dealer lives there.
This case seems different from, we have some cases, I believe, where the warrant is based maybe solely on the word of a confidential informant. Here, it seems like the application consists of the informant's information, but also a lot of other information gathered by the officer. Just looking at the application, I think the first two or three paragraphs are what the informant said, and then the next one, two, three, four, five, maybe six paragraphs are the officer's independent investigation, you know, additional facts the officer has acquired. And I guess, so we have to consider all of that, of course, right?
Well, when we consider all of that, again, a lot of these are just verifying the very public information about Mr. Weigel. A lot of them is the officer saying, yep, I see where he lives, I see his convictions, I see he has that truck, I went to that house, I saw him there. Again, we don't know how long. We don't know how many times he's gone there. We don't know where he went before or after. Then we have another paragraph, again, confirming that he owns this truck. Then he sees him at his house, which is where he lives. Again, a public detail, easily obtainable information. And that's sort of the independent investigation that the officer did. It's mostly just confirming biographical details about Mr. Weigel and then seeing him at that house one time. That's the independent investigation. And I don't think that that independent investigation is sufficient to create a nexus between the truck's movement and location and drug trafficking. Really, none of those biographical details are suggestive of drug trafficking at all. They're just facts about him. They're not even incriminating facts. They're his job. They're where he lives. They're his car.
You've alluded to the intrusiveness of a 60-day, 30-day tracking warrant, 60 days. Is the probable cause standard different in for this kind of a warrant than if, for example, they were seeking a warrant just to search the truck?
I don't know that the standard itself, and I see I have 30 seconds, this might be a minute if I could be permitted to give a full answer.
Feel free to answer the
I don't know that probable cause itself changes. I think it's still the same burden that the state has to prove. But what we're looking at here is just so fundamentally different than other searches. Because this nexus that we normally are talking about is between the evidence and a place. You want to know that it will be in that place. Now with these electronic searches, they're different. So we need a nexus between not just the truck. It's not to search the truck. It's to track the truck's movement and location. The movement of the truck, there have to be sufficient facts about the movement and location of the truck to suggest that he is involved in drug dealing. The only fact we have about the truck's location are two. One is that he was at his home, and two, he was at the house of a known drug dealer. I just don't think that's enough.
Three, that this informant saw drugs in that truck.
Yes, but that doesn't go to the truck's location, just that there were drugs in the truck.
And so the warrant may be issued if there is probable cause that what? Can you finish that sentence for me, please?
Yes, probable cause, there would be, let me get my little rule that I wrote down here. What we need here, there's fair probability that evidence of a crime will be found based on the truck's movement and location, requiring a nexus between that evidence and the movement and location.
It's based upon, so basically probable cause that the tracking, the 60-day observation and the tracking pursuant to the device will yield evidence of criminal activity. Is that right?
I think that's close, but also the idea that there's the nexus between the two. There are sufficient facts alleged to establish that nexus in the warrant. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I'm, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. You've answered my question. Appreciate it. Mr. Raggetts, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. Appellant makes two arguments why Judge Gilligan should not have signed this GPS warrant and why Judge Smith should not have denied his motion to suppress. I intend to address both of those arguments, but I'd like to start by very briefly addressing the standard of review here, because it's important that this is not a de novo review case like Cook and some of the other cases that appellant relies on. Instead, the question here, quote, is limited with great deference accorded to the issuing court. That's State versus Pseudo on page two of my brief. So the question here is just whether, under the totality of all the circumstances and common sense, there was a substantial basis to conclude that there was a fair probability that the search, the GPS warrant here, would lead to evidence of a crime, and doubtful cases are resolved according to the preference for warrants. So with that in mind, I'd like to start with talking about the CRI's reliability, because that really informs the nexus question. And there are four things here that, when taken together, show that Judge Gilligan did not abuse his broad discretion by signing this warrant. The first is that the CRI made a statement against interest. Appellant agreed with that in his brief. Admitting you're involved in drugs is a statement against interest. Under the case law, that matters. That's number one. Number two, the informant's identity was known. He was not anonymous. He could be held responsible if he lied to the police. He was hardly going to curry favor with the police by lying to them. That also is relevant under the case law. Third, and more importantly, the informant provided four details that the police corroborated. And the case law says even the corroboration of innocent details can support probable cause. The informant knew where the appellant lived. He knew what he drove. He knew he worked construction. And he knew he was a convicted felon. And the case law says that alone, even if it's not a corroborated fact, supports probable cause or can support probable cause. So clearly he knows appellant. He isn't just picking some stranger or some neighbor who's annoyed him to set up with the police. Fourth and finally, the CI did here, in a sense, predict future behavior, because he told the police to watch this Maple Grove address, and lo and behold, later, appellant was at the Maple Grove address, or at least his truck was there. So that is future behavior that was predicted, and there's no case law that says the predicted future behavior has to be criminal behavior. The prediction of future behavior just goes to the CI's reliability, and that the CI is well aware of the person he's talking about. And it isn't just his boss who he doesn't like or somebody he barely knows. And we have the fact, of course, that this address was the address of a known meth dealer. So when you take all four of those things in their totality, and when you look at them with the great deference accorded to warrants, Judge Gilligan did not abuse that great deference by signing this warrant.
The informant's information about the presence of firearms, does that help in any way, and if so, how?
It does, because it shows that the appellant is engaged in criminal activity. We know he's ineligible, but we know that nevertheless, within the last 12 days, he's been in possession of a firearm illegally. It's also a common sense notion that drug dealers often have firearms, so that does tie in here too. There's simply no evidence in the record here that suggests that the CI had any motive to lie, and in fact, the CI had a strong incentive to tell the truth if he wanted to curry favor with the police or just not be held responsible for giving false information. Now, sure, he could have been lying, but you could say that about any first-time citizen informant. That's always a possibility, but that's not the question. The question is just whether, under the totality of the circumstances, the judge abused his broad discretion because there was no fair probability that you would find evidence of a crime with a warrant. And that appellant essentially has the burden of establishing that here, given the standard of review, and appellant can't meet that burden of showing that Judge Gilligan abused his broad discretion.
There seems to be a lack of specificity in the warrant application, though, as to when the informant saw this large amount of controlled substance in the truck. Isn't that problematic? I mean, large amount in a truck a year ago versus 2 weeks ago seems to me it would be an important factor for the court to have an understanding of.
That would have been a good fact to have in here. I agree. I don't think it defeats the warrant. It's too bad the date isn't in there. I think it's a reasonable inference the drugs were there in January, because everything else they're talking about is in January. The person was apparently arrested in January. The Maple Grove sighting was on January 6th. The gun was in the last 12 days, which would make it within January. But regardless, I think the fact that there were drugs in the truck really goes to the nexus argument, because it shows that appellant did use his truck for either storing or transporting drugs, as the court pointed out. So this is not some very rare drug dealer who keeps a strict accounting of his car and only uses his car for pleasure, and when he's dealing drugs, he takes one of those rental scooters, an Uber or public transport or something. We know that appellant uses his truck for drug-related activities, or at least did once, and it was a large amount. It wasn't just an amount for a casual user. So there are really three things that go to the nexus here.
Actually, he used the truck twice. One, when the informant saw the drugs in the truck, and the other time when he parks the truck close to a known meth dealer.
Right, and I think appellant would say, well, we don't know if he was using the truck for drug-related purposes then, but the point of the GPS warrant is it may lead you to evidence, like lead you to his association with a known drug dealer. Or in this case, what it actually did was lead to sales that the police observed and evidence found in the trash. So it's not an outlandish theory by any stretch that following a truck of a drug dealer is going to lead to evidence of drug dealing. In fact, I'd say it's the reverse. It'd be outlandish to think that a drug dealer who at least once has had a large amount of drugs in his truck somehow never uses his truck for drug dealing purposes. He always takes public transportation when he's doing drug business. So the three key facts here on Nexus are that the CRI said this is a drug dealer, not just a casual user, and I've already talked about the reliability of the CI. Two, the CI said that he had seen a large amount of drugs in the truck. And three, that just a week before the GPS warrant was signed, the police saw appellant's truck at the residence of a known drug dealer. So when you take all three of those things together and the common sense that Judge Gilligan's allowed to use, it was reasonable to think that he used this truck for drug dealing purposes and that following the truck would lead to evidence. Again, we know that at least once he stored or transported drugs in the trucks. And again, it's not reasonable to think that he never used the truck for drug dealing purposes. Otherwise, he just walked or did something else when he needed to go sell his drugs or pick up drugs or get supplies or deal with all the cash he'd made. That doesn't fit within common sense, and especially not under the great deference standard here, since there was a warrant. Appellant relies on the pseudo decision, but that case involved a casual drug user. It didn't involve a drug dealer. And I cited a number of cases that talk about the inferences you can make about a drug wholesaler. And appellant says, well, there's no evidence that appellant was a drug wholesaler. But if you look at those cases, wholesaler is basically synonymous with dealer. They use wholesaler as compared to a casual drug user. They don't say a wholesaler is someone who only sells drugs to other dealers, and then the dealers sell them to the casual users. A wholesaler, as used in these cases, is just someone who sells a large amount of drugs and isn't just a casual user. And if you have a drug dealer or wholesaler, you can make reasonable inferences about what you would find in their house. And you can also, it was also reasonable for Judge Gilligan to make a reasonable inference that following a drug dealer's truck that has been used for storing or transporting drugs in the past would lead to buyers or suppliers or bankers or some evidence, a storage locker that is involved in drug dealing. So when you take all those things together, Judge Gilligan did not abuse his broad discretion, and Judge Smith did not err by denying the motion to suppress. And unless this court has additional questions, I simply ask that you affirm.
You didn't mention the storage locker. Do you think that adds nothing to the equation?
No, I think that the storage locker, we don't have any direct evidence here that the storage locker was involved in the drug dealing. But again, we can rely on common sense and reasonable inferences, and there's a reasonable inference at least that there's a fair probability, and it doesn't have to be more likely than not, that evidence of drug dealing would be stored in the storage locker, because people often like not to have incriminating evidence where they live. And at least the GPS warrant would give the police the ability to figure out what actual storage locker we're talking about and where it is. And then maybe the police could do a dog sniff or something else to try and get additional evidence. So at least finding the location of the storage locker had a fair probability of leading to additional evidence, and that's all that's required here.
Mr. Donovan argues that that a GPS tracking warrant is very intrusive, and for 60 days it allows law enforcement to, you know, observe somebody's, all their movements, you know, everything they're doing in their life, and that is a lot to give law enforcement based on, you know, so few facts. Do you have any general response to that?
Yes. Under Jones, the standard isn't higher for a GPS warrant. Jones doesn't say this is more invasive. I mean, in a sense, it's less invasive because you're not going into somebody's house and looking at all their personal possessions, or going through someone's car and looking at every personal thing they have in their car, or going through their phone. You're just following them the same way you could if you had an unlimited police budget and could put someone on duty 24/7. So it's less invasive that way. I mean, you do have, per Jones, some sense of privacy in your movements, but it's not the same thing as digging through your phone or your house. And certainly the case law doesn't say there's any higher standard. And in fact, the case law says we want to encourage police to go to judges. Here the police did that. They got permission to essentially follow appellant, didn't just do it on their own. And when the police do that, there's the great deference applied, and all you need is a fair probability that you would that the warrant would lead to evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Raggetts.
Thank you.
Mr. Donovan, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a few brief points on rebuttal. The state was saying that one of the things that show that this informant is reliable is the fact that they know who this informant is. That doesn't make an informant more reliable. That just puts us within the framework of when it's not an anonymous informant, we look at these six factors. So it doesn't make them reliable just because they know that. Second of all, looking again, I'm going to keep hammering on this idea of the truck's movement and location. If we look at how many times we have seen or we have facts alleging information about this truck, it's two. He saw drugs in there one time, and one time they saw it at this house. People use their vehicles all the time.
He describes the vehicle, though, does he not?
He does, but I'm talking about the movement and location of the vehicle. Mr. Weigel certainly is driving a 2014 F-150 truck. But if we're talking about the movement of the vehicle, the nexus between the movement of the vehicle, we only have one fact about where it is at a drug dealer's house. If the police had done something more, if they had trailed him and said, look, we saw him go to a couple different places, this seems pretty consistent with quick drug deals. If, again, the informant had just said, look, we always meet at a third location, or I know that he's a mobile dealer, he's, you know, someone who we meet at this place, I don't go to his house. If we had any of these facts, we'd be closer. But we just don't have those here. And finally, just the idea that this is somehow a less invasive search, I think it's a more invasive search. I think that I would much rather have someone go through my car one time, very thoroughly, than have someone know exactly where I'm going for 60 days. And I'm not even doing anything incriminating. I just don't want people to know that. I think that's how most of us feel. We don't want people to know where we are 24 hours a day versus going through a truck one time. So, unless the panel has any further questions, we would just ask that you reverse this suppression motion decision and also then by extension, Mr. Weigel's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Thank you to both counsel. Case was well argued, as usual. Case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. Counsel in the second case may come forward and get ready. Second case is the Gardner case.